Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And today we wanted to dive into the febrile world that is social media. A couple of news stories caught our attention in recent weeks over in the States. Well, one actually here coming from the States, which has been Elon Musk, the mercurial billionaire, capitalist, industrialist, and best friend of Donald Trump, has been using the Twitter platform, also known as X, that he owns to kind of whip up a controversy here in the UK around what's known as the grooming gangs scandal, which caused enormous ripples in Parliament and politics and in the media here. But then also back in the, across the Atlantic, a kind of slightly out of the blue announcement from Mark Zuckerberg, the founder and owner of Facebook and Meta, its parent company, that they were going to abandon all fact-checking on the Facebook platform. And this is kind of being tied quite closely to, the new Trump administration's dislike of so-called fact-checking. What do you think is going on here, Dad? What are the threads we need to pull together to kind of connect what's going on here?
Yeah, I think this is a very interesting but also troubling developments going on because, of course, what we all recognize, and this isn't news, is that these individual technology chiefs, CEOs, you know, there's a sort of handful of them, six or seven, who are all billionaires and who all, in their different ways, exercise an extraordinary influence over their companies and over their over what happens in the social media space. And an influence which, by and large, is completely opaque, non-transparent, and not really open to checks and balances. I think we can both talk about Musk, who has always been a maverick and figure and an unpredictable, but who's clearly, you know, got extraordinary entrepreneurial skills. And many of the things that he's bet on, like Tesla and SpaceX and other initiatives, have actually turned out to be extraordinarily successful. And then there was this very surprising thing, wasn't it, some years ago when he decided to buy the platform, which was previously known as Twitter.
Yes. It was a couple of years ago, two, 3 years ago, yeah. For an astonishing sum, $45 billion, something like that. And it's now worth only $5, $6, $7, $8 billion. So on financial terms, not a good investment.
Not at all. And yet he clearly felt that owning that platform would give him some additional kind of a megaphone to influence the world, which, of course, was not the intention of Twitter. It was never intended to be a mouthpiece for one tech billionaire. Yeah. I mean, what you've been involved in Twitter from quite a way back, Tim. Tell us about it.
Well, yes. I mean, it was the original description was as a micro-blogging site. You know, it was founded so long ago. I think you initially used the idea was that you would post messages via SMS, which is why it had its famous 140 character limit, because there are 160 characters in an SMS and they needed 20 of them to do some code in the background, so you could only use 140 for your text. But anyway, so it was, the original idea behind Twitter was a kind of, you know, power to the people. We're going to let individuals speak out these little snippets. And, you know, it was very involved in things like, you might remember the Arab Spring in 2011. It was kind of taken up by a lot of the young protesters in the Arab world as they tried to overthrow their dictators as this kind of tool of liberation, giving people their voice. you know, cutting through the propaganda networks on their kind of TV stations and things like that. And there was this surge of enthusiasm, and it was very quickly adopted by the kind of media elite. So lots of journalists, lots of politicians, lots of celebrities, and then brands and companies kind of followed. And it became, for a period of time, the closest thing maybe to a kind of public square online. It never had the raw size of a Facebook or an Instagram. You know, there was, but because the concentration of these kind of tastemakers, cultural elites in various fields, experts and things like that, and media outlets, it kind of drove the conversation. It had an outsized influence, even though, you know, for example, something like Facebook has always had 3 or 4 times more users.
And so there was a period when it did seem to be providing a very much appreciated service for the groups you mentioned, particularly journalists, politicians, experts in different fields, commentators. Since Musk bought it, it's certainly the whole character has changed. Again, you know, what's your experience of that from the inside of someone who's used
it? So I think it's fair to say that it was the platform was already kind of going through waves of internal strife even before Musk bought it. You know, there was a growing sense that it was very easy to kind of harass people on there. They could be bombarded. It's called in a Twitter storm. You know, you suddenly say the wrong thing, or you become notorious in some other way, and people find your Twitter account and kind of bombard you with rape threats and horrible abuse and things like that. And the platform, which initially had quite a strong kind of free speechy approach to these things, was gradually ramping up moderation and other tools and, you know, blocking tools and things like that to try and make it a slightly, like, quote unquote, safer place to be.
Wasn't there also the concern that a lot of the accounts were actually bots? They weren't genuine humans, and that there was a whole question about what percentage of Twitter accounts.
Musk made a big deal out of this when he took over, which he then initially tried to wriggle out of after he'd agreed the deal, because Twitter bit his hand off because he was paying far, far, far too much money for it. So the Twitter board very quickly said, yeah, we'll take it. And then he spent several months trying to wriggle off the hook, claiming, for example, that, you know, the price was too high because Twitter had hid how many bots there were. I'm not an expert on this. My understanding is that, yes, there are bots, there are fake accounts on Twitter, as there are on all social media platforms. I don't think it's a particular problem to Twitter more than any other space. I think it was largely Musk used it as a kind of excuse, and then he changed his mind and did go through with the purchase. The narrative that grew up in right-leaning spaces and from people like Musk was that it had become a kind of insufferably progressive, woke, anti-free speech, anti-conservative platform, and that the Twitter executives and the kind of the team behind Twitter were actively censoring and shutting down conversation and shadow banning right-wing accounts and things like this. And so Musk cast his takeover in terms of, I'm going to restore free speech. I'm going to strip it down to its basics. We don't need these armies of fact checkers and moderators trying to nanny state us. You know, I'm going to, an example of that, he's very conspicuously let people back onto the platform who had previously been banned, famously people like Donald Trump, who was banned after his alleged to have incited the January 6th insurrection, but also some really quite unpleasant people, kind of far right neo-Nazi activists and people who've been banned for kind of, you know, directing campaigns of horrendous misogynistic abuse. So he was kind of making a statement, you know, this is going back to being a free speech zone, public square, everyone is welcome, and we're going to, you know, in theory, make it available for everyone. But what actually quickly happened is that it became kind of dominated by right-wing voices and accounts and influencers who flocked to that platform. And so there's a corresponding kind of exodus of more progressive left-wing types.
And so would it be true to say that quite a lot of those respected commentators, journalists, well-established voices and so on have actually left Twitter, or at least are not active on it?
I think there certainly there have been plenty who have left, and that really accelerated in the last few months around the election of Trump and, you know, Elon Musk's incredibly central role in the new Trump administration. So lots of them are leaving to a platform called Blue Sky, which is a kind of Twitter clone, effectively, but is, you know, run on slightly different lines. I think the problem is that not enough of those kind of key tastemakers, cultural elites, have left en masse to a single alternative platform to shift the center of gravity. So certainly Twitter is a shell of what it once was. Even their own stats show that engagement, number of posts, is massively down since Musk took over. But it's not true to say that, you know, all the journalists have left. Like, there's still every day lots of heated conversation, breaking news, debate, like there used to be, at least in the kind of British Twitter circles that I'm sometimes following. But I mean, I would be an example of someone who is very deliberately and intentionally kind of throttled down their use of Twitter since the Musk took over. And in part, that's just because the experience has got worse. You know, he has an unerring ability to implement policy changes that make it worse for everyone. You know, so little silly things like you can no longer post links to outside things easily. So he wants people to spend more time on Twitter, whereas like an obvious core feature of Twitter is kind of people posting links to other web pages that they think are interesting and just promoting discussion around that. You know, and without that, it's just like, well, I don't want to spend lots of time just shouting into this kind of into the ether. But also there's a massive, he's tried to boost its kind of subscription program. So if you now give him, you know, I think it's $8 or something a month, your replies get massively promoted by the algorithm. So what you see in the feed is this kind of tidal wave of grifters and chancers and weirdos and influencers who have basically paid for prominence. And a lot of them, again, are quite right wing. And so it's just become a much more toxic, hateful, partisan, uncomfortable place, even more so than it was, than it already was before.
And so, I mean, there are two things here. Number one is, if Twitter has now changed, is it likely that somewhere else will become the replacement? Or is it basically always going to now be a fragmented landscape? And then the second question is, how is Musk still using this platform to further his own interests and agenda?
Yeah, so on the first one, I think it is, in a classic piece of journalism, too early to tell. there's been a big push in recent months to make Blue Sky the kind of the alternative Twitter. And I think it's seen massive growth, you know, millions of new people signing up since the inauguration alone, that kind of thing. But Twitter is still, you know, Twitter was 300-400 million people users before. So it takes a lot to try and chip away at that kind of inertia that's been built up. And not everyone is going to Blue Sky. There are lots of alternatives. Even Meta, the parent company of Facebook, has got its own version called Threads, which is kind of tied on to Instagram, which is obviously already an absolutely massive social media platform, which is quite big. There's a few others. There's a silly one called Mastodon. So I think it's too early to know. It's not impossible that one of these does kind of emerge and starts to get this kind of virtuous cycle of having such center of gravity towards it that people are drawn into it. But I mean, to use me as a single anecdote piece of evidence, I've made an account on all these alternatives, but I've not really bothered to build up a follower list and start creating a feed, let alone posting my own stuff, because it just feels like a waste of time because I'm not really sure who is watching. Yeah. So I think it's quite likely it will be fragmented.
So it's interesting, isn't it? Because there are two things, again, that I think about. One example which does seem to have worked and continue to work is Wikipedia. Hmm. Surprisingly, perhaps, despite all this, you know,
works better in practice than it doesn't than it should in theory.
Yeah,
think about Wikipedia.
Yeah. And so, what it shows is it is possible for some kind of collaborative process across the internet to produce a reasonably accurate and safe place for obtaining some factual information.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And Wikipedia remains an invaluable resource. And it is, yeah, remarkable to me that it is as good as it is, given that literally anyone can sign up and create an account and start writing. I think the challenge is to take Wikipedia, which is the kind of definition of kind of slow media, right? It's lengthy, thousands of words long articles in a certain format that are drawn up over time, to the kind of frenetic tempo and pace of social media, which is, you know, a sentence length posts and images and video, billions of them arriving every minute. What I find interesting is that most of, if not all of, the Twitter alternatives are trying not just to build up an alternative power base to Twitter, but also a different model of social media. So they're all part of what's known as the Fediverse, which is a horrible neologism, federal universe. So the idea is that you can take your posts, your follower list, your content, and it belongs to you, not to the platform, and you can just move it from platform to platform. And you can even, you know, open up one platform, write a post, and cross post it across five or six different, because they all use the same underlying architecture. So it's a bit more like email, where whether you use Gmail or Hotmail or whatever else, you can email someone else. Whereas if I use Twitter, I can't send a tweet to someone on Facebook. They're completely separate walled gardens. So that's an attempt to say, let's, rather than build up one megalithic, these kind of handful of titanic corporations in their walled gardens, let's have a plethora of small. You find the platform that works for you, but you own your data and your content. You're not tied to that platform. You can take it away, and you could even talk to people on another platform without having to go and use that particular platform. You know, so I think that is technically quite an interesting idea, and I think fits with the zeitgeist, which is that the internet is getting a bit more fragmented, and the kind of era of these monolithic platforms, is their power is weakening. But yeah, we're still talking a drop in the ocean compared to the billions of people who still live their lives on platforms like Instagram and Facebook.
And the other development, which of course both of us have been directly involved with, is platforms like Substack and others, which allow a single writer to communicate. And it's mainly one way, isn't it? Although there are comments and feedback. And
they've tried to add a kind of Twitter-like functionality to Substack, for instance. So if people don't know, Substack is a kind of blogging newsletter platform, which I happen to use as a journalist. You can follow my Substack newsletter, The Critical Friend, if you just pop that into Google. And it's, yes, it was intended to be a kind of a way of writers and journalists monetizing their content. You build up subscribers and you persuade them to pay you for your articles and things like that, which gets sent to your, originally just straight to your inbox, but they are now trying to develop it into something bigger. So there is a kind of notes element where you can write little short posts and having conversations and comments with your subscribers, and trying to make it more of a Twitter-like substitute.
So the fascinating thing to me about a platform like Substack is that I've become a big fan of this, and have a whole number of individuals that I follow, particularly in the kind of Christian theological area, and also in AI and technology, and some in healthcare. And what it allows you to do is to get a direct, unexpurgated commentary from individual experts, people who you recognize, people who have a track record, people who you trust. And it can be extremely informative, much more so, frankly, than what's called the legacy media. Mm. You know, the big platforms like the BBC or the New York Times or the Guardian or whatever. I find Substack much more focused, but actually a much higher signal to noise content.
Yeah, I think that's certainly an experience of many people. I think in terms of numbers, I doubt Substack really gets close yet to the kind of reach and scope of something like a Facebook or even a Twitter. But I think certainly it's a very positive sign for, you know, journalism was hit very, very hard by the advent of the internet, because it lost a lot of the advertising revenue that had previously funded it, you know, which went to newspapers, and that kind of thing has gone away. And while some people have kind of survived that, like the New York Times, it's primarily by replacing the ad revenue with subscribers. And Substack is kind of cutting out the middleman and saying, well, look, if you want to pay money to read these particular columnists or these journalists, why subscribe to the whole New York Times when you could just pay the journalists directly into their pocket and they have a Substack? And that's been a very profitable model for a small number of very high profile journalists, but increasingly is working even for people way down the food chain like me, you know, who from nothing have been able to build up an audience of almost 1,000 subscribers, over 120 of them pay me. And that actually covers the cost of producing the material and more some. So, yeah, I think it's a very positive model for people who would like kind of rigorous, thoughtful journalism and writing to survive the disintegration of the kind of social media age. But I don't think it's going to replace social media because it's trying to do something quite different.
Yeah, yeah. So then just to loop back then to Elon Musk and Twitter / X. And perhaps we should just talk briefly about the grooming gangs and the impact that Elon Musk has had on the conversation and here in the UK.
Yeah, so this is a strange story, really, because as most of our UK listeners will be aware of, the grooming gangs was a kind of story that erupted here in the UK. I mean, we're approaching 10, if not 15 years ago now, in the early 2010s. When there was a series of scandals when it emerged that in multiple towns across England, gangs of men, many of whom had kind of British, Pakistani, Asian backgrounds, had been involved in sexually exploiting young girls and women. And this had kind of been the police and the local authorities that had failed to spot and stop this. But this, again, this happened 10 or 15 years ago. It was exposed by, quote unquote, the legacy media, in particular, an investigative journalist at the Times. And there has been, you know, criminal prosecutions and inquiries and changes to safeguarding rules. And it's kind of rumbled along in the background, is often talking point of the right wing who would like to kind of, you know, clamp down on immigration. And then all of a sudden, almost out of the blue, Elon Musk, a few months ago, jumps on this topic using his X-shaped megaphone. You know, he now is the most followed person on Twitter, and obviously people know that he has the right, he's got the ear of the president, and so what he says is paid attention to. And he just started firing out tweets about how there was a cover-up and a scandal, and, you know, that the Keir Starmer, who the UK Prime Minister at the time was the chief prosecutor of the UK, was somehow you know, corrupt and involved in allowing these rape gangs to get away with it, which is not true, and it just kind of had this electrifying effect, and suddenly a topic that no one had really thought or talked about for a while was shot back right back up the agenda.
Yeah, I've just been looking at Wikipedia, no less, to talk about
useful resource.
The Rochdale child sex abuse ring, which. Was 9 men were initially convicted in 2012 of conspiracy of offences, calling rape, trafficking girls for sex, and so on. And by January 2024, a total of 42 men had been convicted, resulting in jail sentences totaling 432 years. And 47 girls were identified as victims during the initial police investigation. So to say that there's nothing being done and that it's a real massive scandal. There was a report in 2024 on the Rochdale case, found there was compelling evidence of widespread abuse and that the Greater Manchester Police and Rochdale Council had failed to properly investigate these cases. So, you know,
it's a real scandal. Like, we shouldn't gloss over that.
Yeah, absolutely.
The British authorities, multiple police forces, politicians, we failed vulnerable women and not. And the big thing that hangs over the story was part of the reason we failed to spot it is because we were terrified of whipping up a kind of race immigration based scandal, because these were mostly Asian men targeting mostly white victims, and that prevented people from seeing clearly what needed to be done. You know, I think it's fair to say a scandal which the UK has woken up to and is trying to address, both through the kind of criminal justice system. I mean, Rochdale was just one of, sadly, this pattern has taken place across many different towns. But yeah, it was absurd for Starmer to claim that, you know, it was somehow being covered up until brave truth teller Elon Musk stumbled across the story. Sorry, not Starmer, Musk claimed that. Yeah.
Yeah, and it does seem that, you know, the fact that Musk, this was then the news story, was Musk himself, taken up by the BBC, taken up by lots of the other media, who were just amplifying his claims And then, you know, questions are asked in Parliament.
And it's not the first time. So if you recall last summer, there was a terrible knife attack on a dance class in a town called Southport, which by someone who was actually a British born, but was black and was misinformation, was that he was a migrant. And that provoked weeks of kind of right wing protest and rioting. And again, Elon Musk weighed in his ignorant, ill-informed way, and kind of whipped up, you know, UK's on the brink of a race-based civil war and all this kind of absurd nonsense. And so, yeah, there is a theme here in that Elon Musk is very happy to use his incredible platform to spread misinformation and to, you know, promote his own political agenda. So a lot of his tweets also are trying to drive support towards Reform, which is the kind of populist right-wing party led by Nigel Farage. And the BBC and the kind of quote-unquote legacy media, it feels unable not to jump on and say, well, we must talk about this because, you know, and ask questions at the next press conference. Keir Starmer, what are you going to do about the grooming gang scandal? And is it true that you covered up X, Y, and Z? Mm. And kind of a little bit, it feels like they're the people dancing to the tune of the Pied Piper.
And I suppose at one level, this is nothing new. I mean, you go back to the press barons, you know, they've always, press barons have always had an outsize political influence, haven't they? And, you know, going
Nobody buys a newspaper to make money, I'll tell you that much. You know, the only interest in buying a newspaper is fundamentally for the influence and the power and the status it gives you.
And so questions about the impact of the Daily Mail and the different,
The Murdoch Press.
The Murdoch
is often
Press,
a bogeyman.
Lord Rothermere, wasn't it? I mean, you know, there have been lots of concerns about the power of media barons. Maybe Elon Musk is just the latest version of those.
Well, you can make that case, and I think it's fair to say it's not like we've had, you know, it's never been true that powerful rich men have been able to inject their opinions into the public square. But what is different about Musk is that it is completely unfiltered, you know. So when Rupert Murdoch wants to influence UK politics, he tells the editors and the journalists at one of his various papers to start writing stories about X, Y, and Z, criticizing this, attacking that. But it's one layer removed, whereas literally Elon Musk pulls out his phone and he says the people of the UK should rise up and overthrow their government. Keir Starmer is a paedophile protecting pro-rape gang apologist, and it's unfiltered, and the algorithm of X boosts that into everyone's feeds. And so there's a kind of rawness and an immediacy, much like the difference between, you know, a daily printed newspaper on, you know, dead trees and ink, compared to the fire hose of a live social media feed. There's a rawness and an immediacy and a vibrancy which kind of raises the emotions and the stakes of it. Whereas if it was just, you know, a rich American oligarch had directed their newspaper to start writing about the grooming gangs, it would have had an impact, but it wouldn't have galvanized and electrified the conversation quite so quickly.
And then, of course, the concern is that Musk is now apparently at the heart of the US administration. He's best friends with Trump. He's been given this role to improve efficiency within the US administration. He's doing all kinds of things, demanding to get hold of confidential payroll information and so on. Again, apparently outside the normal checks and balances of the political process. He's not a politician. He's not accountable to anyone. Again, just concerns about checks and balances is, it just seems to be amplified.
Yeah, absolutely.
Before we get back to today's show, I want to introduce you to Christopher Gasson, who has a new book about finding God in atheist books. Christopher, what inspired you to write The Devil's Gospels?
I was running a teenage discussion group at Oxford's University Church when I decided that the best way to help them build their faith upon a rock was to tackle atheism head on. Each month, we explored a different atheist book. I found two things. First, these writers, like Dawkins and Nietzsche, aren't really a threat to God. They're mainly angry about how the church has interpreted Jesus' teaching, and I think we can learn from that. Second, I found that the grown-ups in the church also really wanted better answers to atheist challenges.
So do you think we can become better Christians by reading atheist books?
That's the paradox. But I think it's very much in line with what the University Church is all about. Oxford University was founded on the principle that everything that we can learn about the world will deepen our understanding of God. That's as true today as it was 900 years ago, and it applies as much to science as it does to the humanities, and indeed atheism.
So Christopher, where can we find the book?
The Devil's Gospels is available on Amazon and in all good bookshops. Otherwise, head to thedevilsgospels.com where you can find more details.
Thank you, Christopher. And now back to today's show.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
You know, a lot of the kind of guardrails that liberal democracy has developed to try and protect itself from kind of overpowerful industrialists have been just flagrantly ignored, you know, in any previous time for the last 50, 60 years. If you wanted to have like a major governmental role, you would obviously have to divest or at least put into a kind of arm's length trust your own like media business. You know, you didn't see the proprietor of the New York Times, you know, working for Ronald Reagan as Ronald Reagan's right hand man while also still controlling and publishing the New York Times. It would be an obvious conflict of interest, and that kind of those checks and balances have just been disregarded, as they so often are in Trump world. And you're having something a bit closer to what you get in kind of developing nations, which is where very often, you know, there are a handful of kind of oligarchical capitalist figures who are not just owning, you know, the mobile phone network, but they also own a newspaper and a TV station and the local bank and this branch of, you know, this leading legal firm. And they also are an MP and a cabinet minister, and they just layer on this political and economic power that makes it kind of very difficult for meaningful democratic oversight and accountability to exist.
And this is the oligarchs, isn't it? I mean, this is what we saw in the breakup of the Soviet Union. Again, a small number of very powerful figures who were extremely wealthy and were had political favors. Again, remarkable to see something at least similar to that within the US. Don't want to go too much into US politics.
No.
But the other figure that just to briefly comment on before we think about Christian responses and so on is Mark Zuckerberg, who clearly comes out of a kind of hippie, peace, truth, love man. You know, it's quite interesting. Just I've read a bit about the early days. You know, he bombs out of Harvard and then decides to go to move Facebook to California, to Silicon Valley. Why? Because he likes the Californian vibe.
It's following a tread trod by people like Steve Jobs and others.
Yeah,
but who are attracted to that Californian
free spirit. Information wants to be free.
Yeah,
you know, I'm going to connect every
single
person.
Don't let the man tell you what you can and can't do.
Yeah, and I'm going to connect every single person on the planet. What could possibly go wrong? There's a kind of, you know, a technical brilliance and a kind of naivety, but you know, all the impression was that he wanted genuinely to make sure that the platform, you know, didn't do too much evil, at least at one level. He set up what did he call it? The commission of the...
The Oversight Board.
Oversight Board
kind
of the
Supreme Court
good.
Of Facebook that could rule on some of its tricky moderating challenges and ethics and things like that.
Including the slightly strange figure of Nick Clegg, who was a kind of failed...
Well, he was deputy
British
prime minister.
Yeah, I know. He wasn't the greatest success in that role, though.
Yeah, and then he took up a very senior job at Meta, yeah, which he's just left. Yeah, and then now you see the bizarre side of Mark Zuckerberg, and along with many of the other tech CEOs, second row at Trump's inauguration, you know, bowing the knee, kissing the ring, as Americans would say, to the new power, cozying up to Donald Trump. And as we mentioned at the beginning, there's a real meaningful policy change here, which is that he's announced that Meta products, so that's Instagram, that's WhatsApp, that's Facebook, they will no longer use kind of professional fact-checking services as they have done for many years. But it will be, you know, more like a Wikipedia system where people can kind of just say, I think that's not true, and they can vote on who's right and who's wrong.
But even remarkably, sort of apologizing in public for the misdeeds of having fact-checking
yeah,
in the past.
Those evil fact checkers.
You know, that we clearly got it wrong and we were stopping people from abusing our platform.
Yeah. Well, this is all about currying favor with the new king, who has made it clear through his factotum Musk that, you know, he's a free speech kind of guy. Obviously, Donald Trump doesn't care about free speech. In fact, he's very open about the fact that he would like to shut up people who exercise their free speech to criticize him. But the kind of the prevailing winds are now, you know, to gain access to the new political administration, you need to kind of at least make a nod to the idea that in the bad old days, the tech world was very censorious and scolding and nannying and shut up these proud patriot voices. And so now we must, you know, row back from that and let it become a more free speech zone once more. And that's what apparently is going to happen on Facebook and Instagram.
So then just to try to reflect and respond from this, I mean, I think, you know, number one that strikes me is that this all seems a very long way away from the kind of rather naive techno-optimism. You know, there was 20, 30 years ago that, you know, do you remember it was called Web 2.0, that instead of this passive idea that just a few people
you would be involved as the user in
now, you are going to be able to, yeah, and you can be this the reporter, you can be the, you can create
user generated content. UGC was the
user generated content. That's right. Seems very quaint now, doesn't it? But there was a naive optimism that this would in the end be so much better, you know, that this kind of freedom, the technology would allow humans to speak to one another, to make and understand one another better, a free passage of information. Now it all seems deeply worrying, really. I mean, what's your perspective as a professional journalist?
Well, I mean, we've mentioned, I mean, I think every time we talk about social media, we talk about how bad it is on this podcast. And I think a lot of that is true. And yes, there was an extraordinary amount of naivety that the idea that kind of unleashing mankind, humankind's full gamut of feelings and content and emotions and giving everyone the ability to be a publisher and a newspaper editor and proprietor and a reporter would only be good was clearly naive. And I think you only have to be, you know, an Orthodox Christian to see that, you know, we believe in the fallenness and the brokenness of people. We're not irredeemable. We're not completely lost. We're not incapable of good. But the idea that, you know, giving a megaphone to every one of the 8 billion on the planet, you know, it was going to become a shouty, noisy, angry, hateful place. That was, I think, with hindsight, inevitable. And when you remove a lot of the kind of friction that becomes with being embodied, you know, I can only shout abuse within people who are within earshot of me or people I know. But with the power of of social media, I can now become a kind of troll to millions if I really want to. So we strip away a lot of those limits and creatureliness at the internet does. It was always probably going to end badly.
And there's that well-known quote, isn't it? The lie has gone round the planet before the truth has got its shoes on, yeah. Or words to that effect. That this, and this is part of our humanity, isn't it? That we respond to outrage, we respond to fear, we respond to threat. There's a very obvious...
You call it limbic capitalism.
Yeah,
once.
Limbic capitalism is a sort of... That's slightly different. That's more about desires, I think. But it includes that, because the limbic system certainly is involved in fear and outrage. And, you know, there are centres in the brain, the amygdala, which is particularly activated and seems to have this function in detecting threat. And, of course, it's essential to our survival as a species that we have well-honed threat detectors. You know, you're in the forest and you hear this crack behind you unexpectedly. You know, that could be just something falling of no significance at all, but it could be your one warning that a bear is coming or some or someone else, a human being with a cosh is about to attack you. So we have to have well-honed threat detectors.
And there's kind of an evolutionary take on this, which is that, you know, the catastrophes and the car crash of social media is what happens when you apply, you know, brains that evolved over 100,000 years on the African savannah when we were hunter-gatherer communities to a modern, hyper-industrialized, technological, capitalist, late 21st century kind of model. You know, and in, you know, when you live in small communities, for example, it's a necessary evolved trait to be suspicious of outsiders, because they could bring in disease and they could be a threat, and you need to enforce conformity. You need to make sure that people are doing their fair bit, because otherwise we're at the breadline, we're about to starve at any moment. And also we are, as you say, we have a heightened level of threat because we need to be terrified of predators. And you take all those kind of psychological biases and you accelerate a few thousand years and suddenly we're living on the internet and they all spill out of us in these really destructive, harmful ways. I think that story's a bit reductive, but I think there's elements of truth there for sure.
Yeah, I'm just reflecting on the fact that, interestingly, there are stories which go back in our own history many hundreds of years, like the little boy who cried wolf.
Mm.
You know, so the little boy discovers that going down the street crying wolf has a great response, and lots of interesting things happen. But eventually, when the real wolf comes, nobody's interested. And so, you know, the idea of false alarms, the risk to the community of people crying wolf, I think that's been around for a long time. And also, there's this legal principle, isn't it, that you're not... It's illegal to shout fire falsely in a crowded place. That people, you know, people have died as a result of false alarms. Mm. And therefore there have to be community controls on ordinary citizens sounding an alarm.
Yeah, and that's the classic example of when people say, you know, free speech doesn't actually mean that there can be no restrictions whatsoever on what comes out of your mouth. You know, most established democracies have developed traditions that, you know, yes, you can say what you like, but there are constraints. You know, you cannot incite someone else to kill someone or cause them harm. You know, you can say untruths, but you open yourself up to defamation, libel actions in the courts. And famously, you know, you're not free to shout fire in a crowded theater because it was, you know, unsafe. And so I think we've established over hundreds of years of trial and error how to live well as communities, how to. And I think what a lot of what's going on in social media is kind of speed running through what took us hundreds of years, if not thousands of years, of political and social development, and saying, well, what happens if we have no restrictions? Should we see what happens? And oh my gosh, it's blowing up everywhere, and all these things are happening. And let's try having lots of restrictions, and you know, and getting the exact balance right about how you moderate speech and how you promote kind of healthy community and conversation is actually really hard. And there's a reason why it's taking societies like, you know, Western advanced democracies hundreds of years of trial and error and incremental evolution to land at a place where we can kind of balance competing claims.
But I think there's an interesting other twist here, and that is, I think what you said is very true by and large of European countries, particularly Western European countries with a long history of a democracy and so on. But interestingly, right from the beginning, is it not true to say that the USA took a rather different line on free speech, and that because they came out of Europe, the pioneers, and they felt that Europe was controlled by the elites, right from very early on in the US Constitution, the freedom of speech was put at a very much higher level than would be true in most European countries. I mean, is that fair?
I'm not a constitutional theorist, so I will not claim expertise in this topic. I think that is broadly true, and certainly a lot of people tie it to, as you say, the experiences of many of the earlier people who went to the States were people who had fled persecution, often religious persecution, which is why there is no established kind of state church or religion in the American Constitution. I actually very recently read something which is suggesting that this more kind of untrammeled free speech is a more recent development. And if you look at the context of that clause in the Constitution, what it was really doing was replicating what we had in England at the time, which was the idea of no what's called prior restraint. So censorship doesn't exist. So, in the UK, unusually in the 1700s, anyone could set up a newspaper and print what they like. Whereas in most other countries, you had to get a license and the material had to be checked and approved by a censor. But that didn't mean that there were no consequences after you published. There were actually lots of laws that restricted what you could and couldn't say, and people could be punished in the courts criminally for stuff they had written and said. And there is evidence that some of that carried on in the new United States for a long time. And it's only in the 20th century that this idea of free speech, Article 1, Amendment, the First Amendment, becomes not just no prior restraint, but actually, unless you are literally whipping up someone to kill someone else, you can basically say what you want. There aren't hate speech laws in the States in the same way that most European countries have. You are free to, famous case saw a group of neo-Nazis wanted to march through a Jewish neighborhood and the local council kind of banned the march, and the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, including some actually Jewish lawyers working for them, took the council to court and said, actually, the free speech means that these neo-Nazis are free to go and chant their horrendous anti-Semitic slogans in front of Jewish people's faces. That's what free speech means. So yeah, they certainly have a tradition of more a hands-off approach than we would have in Europe.
I think that's very interesting, isn't it? Because I think most Europeans would feel horrified at that and would feel protecting, controlling free speech. They would want to put it much further back. I mean, or at least to have restraints. And as you say, hate speech, most people are in favour of there being controls on hate speech within reason. And it's fascinating to me now that we have this duopoly in the tech world, we have America, which is wedded to this very hard libertarian sense of free speech, particularly the people who are currently controlling it. And then there's China, which of course has a completely different culture and has no real tradition of free speech. I mean, no. It's basically the emperor who decides what can be said and what should be said. Yeah. And
even more than that, there's this kind of Confucianism in the culture, which idolizes conformity. And so, there's a tradition of kind of vigorous self-censorship, even before the Chinese Communist Party or the emperor's officials get to work. There's this idea of you need to lay down your own individual sense of to do what is proper and what is right for the nation and for the community and for the elders and the ancestors. And so there is, there's no tradition of a kind of a rambunctious, freewheeling marketplace of ideas.
And I think often the Chinese government and many of the Chinese population, I think, look across to the America and think, well, thank goodness we don't have it like that. We have a much more ordered, controlled society. We have a much more ordered public discourse. And so it's just interesting, again, looking forward, to have both of those models seem to be very inadequate. And yet the rest of us who aren't part of this duopoly are basically forced almost to choose between them.
And another social media platform we haven't mentioned, TikTok, is a rare example of something that spans a divide. A Chinese company that has become a smash success in the West, despite it still having this kind of much more stronger, moderation. So, if you go on TikTok and you can't talk about Tiananmen Square if you're operating TikTok in China and things like that. And hence why there is, the Biden administration in its dying days tried to ban TikTok entirely on kind of national security grounds, and now Trump is kind of prevaricating on that. So yeah, I think you're right. There is increasingly a bipolar world. It's like a new Cold War, and China and the kind of China allied systems and states versus a kind of fragmenting, confused Western system. And yet, unlike in the Cold War, we all use the same internet. We all share the same information ecosystem, or in part, and we're all kind of faced with these dilemmas of which model do you follow. I mean, should we close then with a few minutes on what on earth should we think about this as believers? Is the best thing for Christians just to junk their Twitter, Facebook, TikTok accounts? Is it all antithetical to the gospel?
Well, I mean, I think we start with the nature of truth. And it's interesting, again, we've talked about this before. I do think it's very important just to step back a bit and say, why do you think something is true or not within a Christian framework? And that the biblical understanding of truth is a very rich one, but it's certainly not a sort of simplistic idea. And I think it's very closely related to trust. I mean, why do we believe the word of God? Answer: because we trust the person who has written it. We trust ultimately that this has been written by the Holy Spirit. We also trust the authors of the scriptures. We trust them and the eyewitnesses who wrote about Jesus and the eyewitnesses to his life and death and resurrection. We trust them. We trust the people who, you know, why did I ever start reading the Bible? Answer: because my parents encouraged me and modeled the fact that they trusted this book. And because I trusted my parents, I took seriously, so there's a web of trust. And that's not applies not, just not about the Bible, does it? I mean, I was just reflecting, why do I trust Wikipedia? I don't know any of the people in Wikipedia, but by and large, within reason, I trust what I found on Wikipedia. And that's because I trust there are human beings. It's all a human process, isn't it? This is not some kind of algorithm AI that writes Wikipedia. These are human editors who I don't know, but a group of humans together with a commitment to truth. And therefore I trust that process, those human beings. I mean, as I said, within reason, but it, by and large, so it's all based on trust. And then the question comes, is it possible to trust what's happening in the digital sphere? If the essence is about trust. Incidentally, that's why I suspect Substack is quite successful, because I trust here's an individual, a named individual who is a known quantity, who you can identify, who you can see what they've written before, you can see where they come, what their
occupation
is. Accountable
for what they produce.
Exactly. Know? And here I trust, within reason, here's a human being I can trust.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to that. I mean, a potential counter-argument would be, you know, part of the reason Wikipedia works is that it's not just that they just give the keys to anyone, but they say, you can write an article, but then there will be a horde of editors or from all over the world, from different perspectives, who will comb over it and say, what's your source for this? And how do you substantiate that? And I think we could improve the wording here. And it's this idea that through, if you open up to hundreds, if not thousands of viewpoints, we get closer to a kind of golden mean. And that's the fundamental idea that lies behind the kind of development of free speech. You know, because even in the Western tradition, you know, many kings took for granted, you know, why would we let the mass of the populace have, they could say horrible things, they could say ungodly things, they could say untrue things. But the key kind of argument of liberalism was, we can only get to the truth if we have a robust and vigorous marketplace of ideas. If we just say only certain approved people can talk and can be trusted, but if we open up to everyone, yes, there'll be a lot of dross in there, but in the to and fro, in the dialectical dialogue, you know, we can get to something closer to the truth. And so I think there is a danger in Christians kind of retreating too quickly from online sources, from more kind of quote unquote democratic sources of knowledge, and saying, well, I'm only going to trust what has been put out by the respected publishing houses, you know, or what's literally in the scripture itself. When actually, you know, I mean, if we're Protestants, right, the Reformation was turbocharged by the printing press because it suddenly removed the monopoly of control of information from, you know, monasteries in the Catholic Church. And I think that was probably fundamentally a good thing, something that the Holy Spirit was working through. So I think we have to be cautious about saying, you know, we need to retreat back to just trusting those who are in front of us or those who are kind of approved gatekeepers in our community.
Yeah, I understand that, but I also just sense this level of confusion amongst. I mean, I think you're in a privileged position. This is your bread and butter. You're constantly assessing sources. That's what you're supposed to do. You know, that's what we pay you for. Well, some people pay you for it. But, you know, for the rest of us who are not professional journalists or used to the kind of fact-checking, it's rather hard to work out, unless these are people who you know and trust. Well, I suppose one thing, you know, is this is what we need. This is why we need journalists, because you're doing the job. You're doing the, and we need journalists that we can trust.
Yeah, and this will sound like special pleading. So, you know, I confess to that. But fundamentally, that you could say the story of the last 20 years is we had an experiment to see if we could replace professional journalism with citizen journalists and UGC and Web 2.0 and tweets. And it turns out, you know, it doesn't work. You know, actually, there's a craft here. There is a skill, dare I say, in reporting the news fairly and truthfully and accurately and impartially. And it cannot just be done by Joe Bloggs with their phone live streaming something or farting out tweets into the ether.
Yeah,
and actually, if you care about that, let's return and invest your money not in YouTube and whatever else, but finding professional journalists and media outlets that you can trust and getting behind them.
Yeah, but I'm afraid, Tim, we've got a much better idea than citizen journalism, and that's AI. That's the great solution, is that AI is going to splurge out news stories. It's going to do the fact checking. It's going to, I'm joking and being sarcastic, but only partly so, because there are many people who are. This is precisely their solution.
Yeah, and you're already seeing, you know, news websites, in inverted commas, crop up, which are written by no real journalists involved. It's just someone plugging in the headlines and saying, "Can you write me 200 words on what Donald Trump has said?" And it, you know, it might have the superficial appeal of like, yeah, it follows the basic structure of a news story, but you know, it's AI slop, as it's often known. It's torrents of words that appear to be grammatically correct in the right order, but there actually is no human mind behind it. It doesn't know anything. The AI doesn't know anything. It's just a prediction machine. It's just consuming content and regurgitating it, and it can just as easily get easy factual things incorrect as right. You know, this is, we talked about this before, about AI hallucination. You know, you could ask it, what day was Donald Trump inaugurated? And 19 times it will say January the 20th. And then one time it will just say January the 21st. And you don't really know why. We don't know what. It will say it with absolute confidence. And unless you actually separately went to check from, I don't know, a more reliable human written source, you wouldn't know that it got that fact wrong.
Yeah. I mean, the AI boffs regard this as a technical problem, which they are attacking, and they claim that the latest generation, which do their own fact checking and go and check, but anyway, that is an ongoing debate. But I'm with you. I think the only solution has to be human beings who we trust, and I hope and pray that Christians will recognize this as they come into the new era, and will therefore be prepared to put their money in supporting professional journalism, you know, because I cannot see any alternative. I think there is an enormous threat here, and perhaps there's a historically, this is Christians haven't seen professional, they've often seen professional journalists as the enemy, haven't they? Rather than the allies. I mean, unfortunately, again, often the press about journalism and the way that journalists have used their power has often been seen as antithetical to Christian interests, whereas perhaps increasingly it's going to have to be a vital part of understanding the modern world.
I think that's true. And maybe there's a job here for the media to do in terms of winning back trust. Which has been, you know, put through the wood chipper, as it were, in recent years. But I do come back to the idea that if we are to be people of truth, if we Christians are, if the church wants to be known as a kind of bastion, one of the few remaining societal bastions of people who say, actually, whether it really happened really mattered. you know, we're not interested in deep fakes and, you know, postmodernist ideas of you say your truth and I say my truth. No, no, we believe in an absolute truth, an objective truth. There is a real objective reality about the world, and God wants us to know it so that we can respond appropriately. Then I think, yeah, there is going to need to be some bit thinking a bit more seriously about how do we stand up for truth. And maybe one of those ways is returning to the idea of the craft and the skill of professional journalism as an antidote to the kind of maelstrom of opinion that dominates the internet.
Yeah, well, I think we'd be interested in other people's thoughts, wouldn't we, on this? These are developing issues as we watch, and there's a feeling that many of us within the churches are not really well qualified to address this.
I mean, one little microcosm of that would be, you know, as part of the general fleeing from Twitter in recent months, there's been a kind of trickle of church bodies here in the UK that I'm aware of, you know, diocese and the Church of England or bishops or stuff, who have kind of announced that they are abandoning their Twitter profiles and going elsewhere. And then there's been the kind of backlash to that, saying, well, hang on, this is exactly where Christians should be, salt and light. You know, if you flee this space, it's going to become even more dark. And so I think there's still a conversation to be had there about, you know, what is the best. Yeah, fine. Buy a subscription to the New York Times, you know, start supporting, you know, your local newspaper and all that stuff. But there's an ongoing discussion about whether the right thing to do is to pull off social media entirely, or whether to lean in further and say, can we try and steer it back towards something better, something more Christ-like? You know, I don't have a clear answer on that one. So, yeah, we'd welcome your thoughts if you're an avid tweeter or Instagrammer, or whether you've gone cold turkey and abandoned it entirely, and what people in your churches are doing. Do get in touch. You can email us molad@premier.org.uk. We'd love to hear your disagreements, your comments, but also suggestions for things we should be talking about on the podcast, news stories or developments in science and technology you'd like us to respond to. And don't forget, as always, lots of great material on Dad's website, johnwyatt.com. Including on this topic of technology and the internet, some previous episodes of this podcast, but also some other writing as well. And you can also find some of my journalism on my website, tswyatt.com, including links to my aforementioned Substack newsletter, The Critical Friend, which is a weekly email every Friday, in which I offer some analysis and commentary on the big church news stories of the day. So thanks for following along with us. We'll be back next week with another episode, but until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
McDonald's tiene la clave para un post-game meal de campeones. Una QPC con salsa barbecue y tocino, papitas y un refresco. Los pros le llaman el Angel Reese Special. Llévate el Angel Reese Special solo en McDonald's.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
En McDonald's participantes por tiempo limitado.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.